If this sermon seems to you like a departure from the typical themes I deal with, it's not my fault. I've mentioned from time to time that I choose my biblical text from the lectionary. That is a three-year cycle of scripture readings, one from the Old Testament, one from the Gospels, one from the Psalms, and one from the Epistles. And the beautiful thing about this is that on any given Sunday, we know that there are hundreds of thousands of preachers all over the world who are preaching on the very same text. And that's good to know that I'm not alone on this one, because most pastors do not preach from the Song of Solomon. I don't believe I have ever done it either, and it may be the last time I do it as well. Because reading the Song of Songs makes you wonder how in the world something like this could have made it into the Bible in the first place. First of all, there is no mention of God through the entire book. The only other place this happens in Scripture is in the book of Esther, because Esther is mum on God, but it is also unique because it is the only place in Scripture where the entire eight chapters are coming from the perspective of the female voice. Now, I introduced my message with Wayne Fontana's 1960s hit, The Game of Love, because the Song of Solomon is all about and only about love. Not the agape love that we speak of so often in the church, which is that love that God shows for us and the love of God we share with one another. Agape love is the kind that lays itself down for another the way Christ gave his life for our behalf. It is not the Greek philios love, which is the love of brothers and sisters. And if you want to play with words, Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love. It's not that kind of love. It's not the Greek stergo love, which describes the love that exists between parents and their children. No, the Song of Solomon is about eros love. And do you know what word we derive from eros? Erotic. And I can see some of you squirming already, because the Song of Solomon is eight solid chapters of impassioned romantic longing of a young couple for one another, which reads more like a romance novel than it does scripture. Now, some Christians will say, well, that's not what this is really about. This is an allegory of the relationship between Jesus and the church, which Sarah pointed out. But I find it interesting that in churches that say they take every word of Scripture in a literal manner, even though they look at it that way, they make an exception here. We're not going to interpret this one literally. It's about Jesus in the church. And I can understand why they do that. It's much easier to preach about an allegory than it is to speak about the ecstatic emotions of a man and woman in the throes of romantic love. It reminds me of the story of that elementary school boy who was asked by his teacher to write a report on Benjamin Franklin. And it went like this. Benjamin Franklin was born in Boston. He soon tired of that, and he moved to Philadelphia. When he got to Philadelphia, he was hungry, so he bought some bread. He put the loaf of bread under his arm. He walked up the street. He passed a woman. The woman smiled at him. He married her and discovered electricity. Bet you did not know that. Hear these words of Scripture. My beloved speaks to me and says, arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. For now the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The flowers appear on the earth, and the time of singing has come. The fig tree puts forth its figs, and the vines are in blossom, and they give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. Now, I can't tell you why this scripture made it into the Bible. Best I can tell you is why it is not in the Bible. You don't read it so it can do you some good. You don't read it as the five steps to a fruitful, fulfilling marriage. It is not to tell us something, to tell us to do something good for God. It won't work as a desk calendar of inspirational quotes that you flip over every day. It is not a book about morals. It is not a dating manual. Reading the Song of Solomon probably won't change your life. But that's not what it is supposed to. It sits there, sandwiched in between Ecclesiastes and Isaiah for no apparent reason other than delighting in the delight of this young couple and having it described in, what shall we say, erotic terms. Let's go a little bit further in the Song of Solomon, shall we, and hear these words. Oh, how beautiful you are, my love, how very beautiful. Your eyes are like the doves behind the veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from the washing. Your lips are like a crimson thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like the halves of a pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David. Your two breasts are like twin fawns, the twins of a gazelle that feed among the lilies. Until the day breeze and the shadows flee, I will hasten to the mountain of myrrh and the hill of frankincense, because you are altogether beautiful, my love, and there is no flaw in you. Now, men, tell me, when was the last time you looked in your wife's eyes and said, your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes which come up from the washing? Women, tonight, before you go to bed, I want you to look into your husband's eyes and say, your body is ivory work encrusted with sapphires. Your legs are alabaster columns set upon bases of gold. Your speech is most sweet and altogether desirable. And you must say that without laughing. Oh, it may sound silly to us, but that's the way love always is when you're on the outside looking in. Because if you've never fallen head over heels in love, you will not get the Song of Solomon. Because when you are in love, you throw abandon to the wind, and you willingly make a fool of yourself and do things that are completely out of character. The big jock will write sappy love poetry. His girlfriend will wear his letter jacket and class ring. Guys will spend money they don't have on what they can't afford for gifts for their beloved. One of them may take a can of spray paint and spell Jim plus Jenny on some highway bridge overpass. Who knows, they may on impulse go get tattoos of each other's names on their arms or somewhere else on their anatomy. And only afterwards think, boy, I hope this relationship lasts a long time. Sue and I ate at an Italian restaurant on what happened to be a prom night for one of the area high schools. And there was this one adorable couple that was way over the top. And this guy was trying every tool of the trade to impress his date. We watched them come in, and he seated her in a gentlemanly manner. And there was the candle in the center of the table, and they looked lovingly into each other's eyes, maybe see the reflection of that flickering candle and holding hands across the table. And after they placed their orders, this young man pulled out a little box and he opened it and he started tossing rose petals on the table. And I was looking at this and I was half sick to my stomach. And the icing on the cake is when their two giddy mothers came in to snap all kinds of pictures of Cinderella and Prince Charming. It was embarrassing. I wanted to grab the kid by the arm and haul him outside on behalf of all of the male gender, say, son, we've got to talk. Because the time is going to come years from now when you're going to look back on this and you're going to think, rose petals? Why on earth did I do something like that? Well, the answer is love. Love does that to you. You're willing to look silly to an outsider because it feels perfectly natural to you when you are smitten, you are preoccupied with the thoughts of the other. I wonder if he's thinking of me right now. Or I wonder if she thinks of me the way I think of her. Togetherness is bliss. Separation is torture. But then something incredible happens to these relationships. They go from romantic love into uncharted territory. The fig tree sends forth its blossoms and the vines bloom so lovely. And what happens is that you are no longer preoccupied with I. Because now you're thinking from the frame of reference of you. What is it that I can do for you? That is what matters most. Now, there was once a time when Stan and Carolyn were Stan and Carolyn. They were two individuals, and then this gift of God came along, and Stan and Carolyn got all entwined and their lives got all complicated and they got coupled. I love that word. God coupled them. He took two individuals and made a couple. And so now Stan and Carolyn were Stan and Carolyn. And you can't think of one without thinking of another. You see, the I turned into a we. A new creation happened. And Jesus talked about that when he was talking about marriage, and he said, the two shall become one flesh, and not even the Clydesdales can tear them apart. Oh yes, when that happens, the inconsiderate people start caring about others' feelings, the self-centered, defer to the wishes of the beloved. They change themselves in ways that they could scarcely have imagined. Because that's what Eros has the potential to do, to change you thoroughly. Now, when my kids were little, they loved it when I read from a book by Judith Viorst called If I Were in Charge of the World. And the one they loved most was about a boy who had fallen in love with a little girl named Lizzie Potofsky. I can't get enough of Lizzie Potofsky. I love her so much that it hurts. I love her so terrible I give up my gerbils plus 22 weeks of desserts. I know that it's Lovsky because Lizzie Potofsky is turning me into a saint. I smell like a rose. I've stopped picking my nose, and I hardly ever say ain't. I don't push and shovesky because Lizzie Petusky likes boys who are gentle and kind. I've stopped throwing rocks. I'm changing my socks. And to tell you the truth, I don't mind. You can put tacks in my shoes, feed me vinegar juice, plus lots of other mean, bad, awful stuffsky. But promise me this, I will not die without a kiss from my glorious Lizzie Petofsky. It happens to little boys. It happens to grown men. Love has that wonderful potential for changing us for the good. But unfortunately, along with this message, we also have to say, I love you doesn't always mean I love you in the right way. I love you can mean I love me and I want to use you to love me more. I love you may mean I want you to meet my needs. I love you may mean I want to rescue you and reform you and turn you into someone just like me. I love you may mean I want to use you as a sex object. And when the thrill is over, then I will move to someone else and say, I love you. You can't go on just the words themselves, can you? Because when it comes to marriage counseling, I do it in a very pointed way. When couples come in for preparation for marriage, the first question I ask them is, so, why do you want to be married? And the answer, almost 100% of the time, is because we love each other. Why else? Well, we love each other. We're soulmates. We were meant for each other. We love being together. It feels good. And then I'll ask, well, what happens when it doesn't feel good? What happens when her annoying little quirks get on your nerves and eventually drive you up the wall? What happens when Mr. I will be there for you always turns into Mr. Seldom See? I say to the man, what happens when Miss America drools on her pillow and in the morning she looks like she's come out of the spin cycle of a washing machine? What are you going to do then? What happens to love when it doesn't feel like love anymore? Oh, it's an amazing thing, isn't it, when two individuals meet and they like what they see and it piques their interest and their curiosity and that leads to romance and infatuation and that something new is created when an I turns into a we. And they do not evaluate their relationship on the basis of what good is coming from it or what am I getting out of this. And their love takes the risk of looking stupid and they don't care. And they can read a 3,000-year-old book in the Old Testament and understand perfectly what it means. And they're willing to put that love to the test in a marriage promise, declaring that they will love one another for eternity. I'm telling you, that's something to marvel at. It's something to write home about. It's something to thank God for. It's something to cherish. It's a sign, as the writer of the Song of Solomon said, it's a sign that a new season has come. So arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. The winter is past, and the flowers appear on earth. The time for singing has come. The fig tree puts forth its figs, and the vines are in blossom. Let me see your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet, and your face is lovely. Go to it.